This week on Death of the Reader, did Nox's chapter save the day, or did he phone it in? Dr. Malcolm Ryan is in to talk detectives and game design. And how many Rudges can the story contain? You're on Death of the Reader. You're listening to 2SER 107.3. We are Flex and Herds bringing you Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour. Shout out to the Meter family for their wonderful little theme song they cooked up for us there. Today, Herds, we're continuing The Floating Admiral. We're dealing with chapters 5 to 8. So far in the story, the Admiral, Lord Penniston, has found himself bludgeoned to death in the bottom of a boat.
Wait, bludgeoned? Wasn't he stabbed?
Well, he was clearly, you know, squashed under all of this sheer reasoning we've been given by the Detection Club, our authors.
You know what? I believe that. That is a straight up fact.
Oh my goodness.
I feel similarly.
This story is excellent if you approach it as the game it is.
It is a fun time, but I was definitely not prepared going into this. This is like, it's ridiculous.
I told you last week we'd thrown you a curveball.
Yeah. Yeah, you threw me about 18 curveballs. They're all, each of them slightly differently curved.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Now, I think that the main message we can take away from this and last week is that the more authors we have, the more confusing it gets.
Here's the deal. I'm enjoying reading the novel. However, there is no real story. It is just focused on all of the authors coming in one after the other. It's like a parade. It's like clowns coming out of a clown car. You know, you see one clown, and come out, you think that's pretty funny. You see like two or three come out after them, you're like, well, that's crazy. Look at all those clowns in that clown car. But then there's about 10 of them coming out of this tiny car, and you're like, man, that's insane. What is happening? I am not comfortable. I need to take a breather. I need to take a vacation.
Yeah, it's definitely a little ridiculous, but admittedly, they did tell you what it was going to be in the introduction.
It is impeccable at following through on its own premise, in that it is 12 people, one after the other, shouting at you at what they think the mystery is or what the answer is. A bit of both, really. I've been reading through. You're the one who's read it all, and I haven't read anything, and I'm having a great time, but I am just perplexed. Because clearly there are all these different answers that are being put towards me, and I don't know which one to pick. And some of these mysteries, I'm not even sure if they mean anything. One that jumped out at me was the house key puzzle, which I don't even know what's happening there. The Admiral has a key to his house, but he keeps the door latched or unlatched, but he has a key, so that doesn't really matter.
Well, yeah, the whole thing is that the key was found in the bottom of the boat where his body was found, and it's like, so he had a key to his house?
Yeah, he had a key to the house that he lives in? Like, where is the mystery there? You know, oh, it was locked when he left, or it wasn't locked, but like, he left with the key in his person. Like, I don't understand what the problem is there. There's a lot of weird mysteries, and there are some that are, because that's like, that's the setup, you would think, to a locked room mystery, which is quite an iconic sort of, you know,
well,
puzzle.
I think that the key to the French door, as it's described.
Is that a pun? Are you going to make a pun out of this?
No. I mean, like, the physical key in the story.
Good.
Was meant to be a thread that was thrown for the other writers in the story. But so far, no one has picked up on it.
No one's.
And they all keep bringing it up and ridiculing it for how pointless it is.
Yeah.
And on the one hand, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah.
On the other hand, it's like, oh, just leave it alone already.
Yeah, it's very strange. I will say, shout out to our boy Nox. Once again, bringing up some very strangely absurd writing, as in the three taps, which we've discussed previously. He really brings up, or rather brings down, I suppose, the pacing of the story, which I really appreciate because, as I say, I said this last time we had a chat about this, every single author is trying to cram as much reasoning, as much mystery as they can into the story. Whereas Nox, he says, hey, I'm going to lay out 39 things that I think you should think about. And that's it. That's all the chapter is. It ends with a lovely little nightmare of Mrs. Davies being whacked to death with a rolled up newspaper. But other than that, nothing of import happens. It's just laying out some thoughts and some theories, which I really appreciate.
I think the first thing for me was when I read through Nox's chapter initially, I thought to myself, ugh, what a lazy sod. He didn't even try. But going through in a reread, I think that there was a brilliant self-awareness with which he delivered the chapter.
Mm.
I particularly enjoyed the opening section where he was basically bemoaning how boring Rudge is.
Yep. He doesn't really have a character.
Yeah, but I think as we got on to later in Knox's chapter, and especially going over it the second time, there was a really fantastic self-awareness, as I said, to the way he delivered it. I really enjoyed in particular when he quoted his own Chinaman theory from the from his rule set that we discussed when, you know, going over the three taps, which you can find on the podcast.
Yeah.
Now, the thing is, Herds, having read over Knox's chapter, do you think that this story will follow?
Will follow the rules of Knox?
Yes.
I feel like the rule that sticks out to me as the most likely to be broken is that
it is important that the actual perpetrator is introduced.
The only way that I think that they'll try to get around that is that he was mentioned in the prologue. I still maintain out of those, the two captains, one of them is Peniston, the other one is some other character. I haven't figured out who. Uh-huh. I think they're the murderer. But like, I think that by that rule in particular, I don't think that it's very easy to hold up, especially with all of this back and forth, all this jumping around of who's the killer, who's not.
I read a letter from Knox, which was about the writing of mysteries in a group.
Okay, cool.
And I don't know whether it was before or after this story. It may have even been one of the inspirations for this story, but it was not clearly dated.
Uh-huh.
But basically, he was saying that more often than not in the murder mysteries of his colleagues, the first person mentioned in the entire story, other than the person who died, was the culprit.
I mean, that's the easiest way to write a mystery.
Yeah.
Because then no one can complain. They can't say, oh, well, you didn't spend enough time looking at them. Like, well, they were the first thing in the books. So obviously, you should be focusing your attention on them. Which I can't think off the top of my head was the first person mentioned, but the first significant person in chapter one is certainly where, which obviously is why I was drawn to him. I still think there's a case to be made for Webb, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah, I've spent so much of this story referring not to the actual chapters, but more to the preface by Dorothy L. Sayers, where she describes how the story came to be.
Right.
Because I think that looking at the story under that microscope is perhaps the most fascinating way to analyze it.
Sure.
Particularly when we get to the fact that, you know, this was a group of friends who liked to sit down for dinner parties.
Yeah.
Right?
I think that by having all these authors come together and really put their best foot forward and everyone's trying to, you know, like step on each other's toes in a sense, everyone's trying to work forward. I could imagine a scenario where Knox came across this story, read the first seven chapters, said, there's no way this abides by my rules, and said, I'm out. I'm done. Like, I give up on this. This is not going to work. But he went full ham, providing us with 39 reasons why we should continue to try to puzzle it out. And that's certainly how I read his chapter. I don't know. I really appreciate that. I appreciate that he stuck it through and that it was continuing to be written. So even though I'm sitting here having only half a mind about what's going on, still, I suppose, pushing for Nettie Ware as the killer, I still feel like there's plenty of room to throw more crazy stuff in and for the authors to have a really fun time. And that's really what matters in this story.
I think that so far in the story, they have definitely failed at the goal that they set themselves of not having each author introduce a new puzzle needlessly for the reason of complicating things.
There's a new puzzle in every chapter except for Knox's, I'm sure. And Knox, again, carrying the team on his back, he lays down that support ground for the rest of the novel. It's kind of like a reset button, which I think is really cool.
Yeah, that is kind of why I chose to stop here.
Yep.
Because I think that it's a valuable place to sit and reflect before we get into the mess that is the following four chapters.
What do you mean it's going to get more messy?
to say nothing of the content, the last four chapters is as long as the first eight.
Oh, good.
Coming up later on the show, Herds is going to lay down his theory as to why Nettie Ware is the one true, only possible culprit.
I got it, guys. Don't you worry about me. I got this.
And also, we'll have to reason out what we think Agatha Christie's solution is.
Oh, boy.
But before we get there, we have Dr. Malcolm Ryan from Macquarie University here to talk a bit about game design and how it affects the world of detective fiction. You're listening to Death of the Reader.
Hey, you're listening to Death of the Reader, your murder mystery world tour on 2SCR 107.3. We're here with Dr. Malcolm Ryan, lecturer in game design development and indie game developer from Macquarie University. How are you doing today?
Good, thanks.
That's excellent. It's a pleasure to have you here. So I've brought you on as a special guest to kind of talk about the history of interactivity in fiction, because we're doing this murder mystery show, and we love to talk about how murder mystery is the old video game. It's a pastime that people used to sit around and talk about. You know, this is who the murderer is. This is who we think it is. It's a sort of interactive fiction that people can get involved in. And we're particularly interested in how detective fiction can be seen as an interactive medium. So I guess I wanted to ask if you can tell us about some earlier examples of interactive fiction, maybe some old video games or anything else you know about that.
Oh, wow. interactive fiction, really, some of the earliest video games, before you even call them video games, I guess, were what's now called interactive fiction, because graphics was terrible back then.
Sure, yeah.
I remember the first game I ever played was called Pyramid 2000, and it was on my old Tandy TRS-80, and it was a purely text adventure about exploring a pyramid and rescuing treasures from the pyramid.
And why do you think there's that drive there to engage with these interactive, stories and experiences?
For me, ultimately the answer is because we can, right?
Of course.
We make art because we can, and this is another opportunity to do something interesting.
No, for sure.
What's engaging about it, we always like the idea of getting caught up in the story in some sense and being able to be part of the story rather than just witness at that. And I think that's what games can offer us in one way or another. Mm. There are a whole bunch of tricky design problems in making that work. It doesn't just automatically transfer. You can turn a story into a game.
Yeah.
I think that's really what drives it. We've always liked stories and always wanted to get that dream of getting caught up in the action in whatever way it is.
You don't wonder if there's a little bit of wish fulfillment in following on the story of the detective, solving the crime, saving the day. Maybe there's something to that.
Yeah, you want to, the game gives you, traditionally a detective story, you're doing that, you're even though you are not the detective, you are still being the detective in some sense.
Absolutely.
Along the way. And the game now gives you the opportunity to actually to fulfill that fantasy to yourself, be the detective, make the clever observations, the leaps of deduction that can solve the mystery.
The eureka moments, of course, yeah. I guess I wanted to ask, you've played a few video games.
A few, yeah.
Yeah, what sort of reflections of the detective fiction's approach of interactivity can be seen in more modern interactive media?
For me, it comes down to thinking about if you want to fulfill the fantasy of the player being the detective, then I think you've got to think about what are the main things the detective does and how do you make the player feel like they're doing those things.
Mm.
So I was thinking about this when you invited me. I was thinking, if I was going to design a detective game, what would be my design goals?
Because
the approach that I usually take to designing a game is sort of work out, broadly speaking, what kind of experience that I want to create, and then work out how I can build mechanical things into the game that enable me to have that experience and to convey that experience to another player.
Yeah.
And so I think the experience of being a detective is like exercising a certain set of skills, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's the skills of observation, of deduction, maybe of interrogation.
Yeah, of course.
Maybe I could, depending on the kind of detective that I'm going to be, maybe I'm a Sherlock Holmes kind of detective who just, looks at the scene and picks out the key details that are really important. Or maybe I can make various, clever leaps of deduction from one thing to the next.
Yeah.
Or maybe I'm the kind of detective who, grabs you by the shirt collar beats the truth out of you in some fashion.
Yeah.
You've got to think about what sort of skills is the player going to employ and then how do we test those skills within the game.
Do you think that there are more strengths or weaknesses to a game or to an interactive medium that integrates its puzzles fictionally? As an example, you might have played a game like Transistor, which is it's about a computer program trying to survive a system breakdown by defeating bugs in turn-based combat mechanics. It's all very integrated with the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
You would say the fiction is even a sort of a background thing in that sort of game. But in a game like The Witness, is a very popular it's a puzzle game, but the line-based puzzles that we play through and that we engage with, they really don't have anything to do with the plot in that game. It's a pastime. It's something to pique the brain, I suppose. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so when we talk about design, we talk about the idea of, your game has some fantasy attached to it. You are pretending something, and that pretending might have some story attached to it. It might just be so. I mean, the pretense in The Witness is fairly is just you are wandering around on some mysterious island where there are a bunch of puzzles, and it isn't trying to play. It isn't trying to give you a plot. It isn't trying to give you a reason why these puzzles exist or anything. It's just it's an interesting place in order to set the puzzles, and I mean, it's very well integrated with, I mean, the way those puzzles work with the environment is remarkable, but it's not trying to tell a story.
Yeah.
On the other hand, other games, might have more of a narrative goal, and it might be trying to say, you're not just some random person. I mean, you don't, in The Witness, you are not anybody. You are just the player, right? Yeah. But in other games, you might be somebody who is trying to achieve something in some narrative. And then you have to think, if we're designing those kinds of games, you have to think then how do we fit these things more seamlessly into that narrative. Because, so we talk about, in design, talk about the idea that a game has two narratives. Mm. It has the sort of external narrative, which is the narrative that's written onto the game, where the game tells you this is a game about whatever it is about. So Mario Kart says, everything, the art, the everything about that game says, this is a game about racing cars, right? Mm. But then there's also the internal narrative that comes from the mechanics of the game, comes from what you're doing in the game as the player. And Mario Kart does that well because the internal mechanics of that game are also about racing cars, and the kinds of drama that comes out of the play matches the kind of drama that you would have from a good car racing game. Mm. Whereas other games, the kind of narrative that comes out of the play is quite distinct or different from the narrative that's imposed from on high. Yeah. I mean, the classic example for me of that is any RPG game which tells you, oh, this mission is really urgent. Yeah. If you don't save this person soon, they'll die. Yeah. But actually the mechanics say, but you can go off and do any number of side quests before you address that, and that person will still be on the edge of death no matter when you arrive at wherever they are.
Do you think that stories like that, with that dissonance there, do you think that they could be improved by taking a look at older approaches or detective fiction or anything like that?
It's a big problem. I mean, partly I found that games have just suffered from bad writing. I mean, games have traditionally neglected their writing. And even the games that are recognised as being the best written games pale in comparison to the best written novels, right? They are adequate at best. And so a lot of the games we talk about, this game has amazing writing. I mean, really, if we compared this to any novel, it would be a fairly cheap novel.
Yeah,
it wouldn't
for sure.
be a classic by any means. Mm. So partly the problem, I think, could be addressed by just paying better attention to writing. And and especially in the detective genre, there's an essay by Chesterton, who was one of the early detective fiction writers.
Yeah, he's an excellent he's known for his juxtaposing descriptions and his paradoxes in his writing. Apparently that's what he's known for. Yeah, and tell me.
But there's an essay he wrote where he talked about how detective fiction is one of the most prescriptive forms, in that it has there are distinct patterns for how a detective novel works, and it's basically a design pattern. It tells you, here's how to design a good detective novel. You do follow these steps. Mm. And he very much believed that his writing was formulaic in that sense, because there was a recipe for a good detective novel.
Yes.
And from a game design point of view, that's really interesting for us as game designers, because we can then see that same design pattern that he's using, and we can say, how can this design pattern be taken from literature into games? The kinds of storytelling that we'll talk about in game design is very still very much based on, for example, the Joseph Campbell Hero with a Thousand Faces.
I see.
Is very popular in games because it's this nice design formula for telling a story.
Yeah.
But sometimes that gets caught up as the only formula for telling a story.
Yeah.
Every game story has this heroic narrative. And even then it's done badly. Mm. And so I think there are a lot of different genres that have a lot of different forms and what I would call design patterns for how they work and how... And we could think about how these different genres of writing work and bring some of that knowledge into how we're designing games that tell different kinds of stories, games that tell detective stories, games that tell romances or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I was going to say it's all about breaking the rules, breaking the form, but in a way that is intelligent, not just to break the rules.
Absolutely. Mm. I am a firm believer in learn the rules and then break them creatively.
Yes, absolutely. I think that might be all the time that we have for today. You've been listening to 2SCR 107.3, Death of the Reader. I've been Herds, and that was Dr. Malcolm Ryan.
Are you ready for Netty? Because I'm ready for Netty, and Herds, I hear you are as well.
I am the most ready, Netty. I'm ready for Yeti. Hey!
Woo! We made it. You're on 2SER 107.3. This is Death of the Reader. We are discussing The Floating Admiral, chapters 5 to 8 by the Detection Club. Now, this is the part where Herds comes to me and says, Flex, I have a solution for everything in the book. I have solved it with such grandiosity that I will earn your credited points when we reach the third part.
That's what's happening today, clearly, because I know exactly what's happening, and you haven't given me the most complicated puzzle that has ever existed. It's garbage. Anyway.
Now, last week, Herds was big on the Netty Ware train. Mm. He was clearly the sailor mentioned in the prologue having been written after the rest of the story.
Yes.
Now, I don't think I can disagree on that. I think that the connection between the introduction, Netty Ware, and the Admiral is an admirable one to make.
I don't even know what to make of that. Are you saying that I'm right? Is that what's happening here?
I'm saying that given the difficulty of the puzzle, making such an obvious face value connection as though it was put there on purpose to mislead you or something.
No.
You're a miracle worker, Ben.
I will say I think that Netty Ware is still a valid candidate for the murderacy. However, I also think that Holland has a pretty good case for him. And this Wilfred fellow, who we haven't met and we know next to nothing about, I'd like to revise slightly. I think that he might actually be the murderer.
Who?
Wilfred, maybe.
He's barely been in the story.
I know, but that's what makes him so suspicious. He's barely even there. I'm just saying, maybe he's the guy who shows up at Mrs. Davis' place and pretends to be the Admiral. Maybe he's allowed to do that because he used to be a captain just like the Admiral did, and so he was able to impersonate him. In the same way, those two boats looked exactly the same except for their colors they were flying.
I see. Now, the one thing that I do then have to question is between Netty and Sir Wilfred, the two sailors we supposedly have in the story, and Holland, who supposedly gets his materials from China. Like, what's your motive here, Ben? You've just picked people. You've not given anyone alibis.
I know.
You're basically throwing darts at a blank dartboard.
Hold on. I don't have to give anybody alibis. That's their job to give me alibis. And my job to be like, no, that's not true.
I disagree.
I said so. Why would I give them alibis and tell you why they weren't at the scene of the crime?
No, you need to work out whose alibi is correct, whose is contradictory.
That's not my job.
Especially when we get to things like the train puzzle, which, as we have pointed out to us later in the story, the train puzzle is clearly misleading to try throw a fake alibi in there, right?
Yes.
Now, this is a story clearly written by multiple authors trying to have a fun dinner party puzzle with each other, but does that not mean that they'd be trying to make a difficult puzzle by making overlapping alibis and contradictory alibis such as one certain train?
I mean, that's definitely the plan. I'm generally not good with time puzzles in particular. But yeah, the train puzzle is definitely something that Mrs. Davis tries to work out or provide some clues for. But even then, we don't even know if it's the Admiral who she's talking to when they said that they had to go catch the train anyway. So, you know, it's a bit silly. In answer to your question about the motive, I think that the two most obvious motives that we have in the story, one, if we pull on the sailor thing, there was some slight that happened back in the day. There's some lost honor going on in the military. You know, the story in the prologue about how there's this one officer, or this one captain who's really all over the place. He's getting drunk. He's in the opium dens and he's getting court-martialed. And then the other one who is, you know, contradictory codes and morals, but he would never, you know, stray from someone who was in trouble. there's an obvious conflict there that has happened. Whether that's the only motivator going on here, I'm not sure. The other motivator obviously is money. We spend a lot of time through chapters 5 through 8 talking about how, you know, the Admiral had this money and there's this will that means that his niece will get all his money when he dies, and like that he doesn't want her being married to Holland, but maybe he does because there's a letter that shows up later, which is, you know, fantastically convoluted. But I don't think that Holland is the murderer. Because the way that he interacts with Rudge in particular, we are told that he seems like he doesn't know what he's saying. It seems like he's coming up with information. He's jumping back from alibis. Like, the behavior that he's exhibiting doesn't make sense for a criminal. It seems more likely that he's trying to cover for someone else. Although it's possible that he, you know, he did the deed in place of Elmore, in place of Wilfred, in place of someone else. And so that's him trying to, you know, take all the blame onto himself.
We've clearly had him tied up in China. He's clearly tied up with Elmer Fitzgerald. We've also heard that the Admiral and his niece are more like husband and wife. So could we not then argue that Holland just is the Admiral?
It's funny you should say that. I don't have quite that theory, but I do have some ideas. Something that's been brought up a couple of times with mainly Chapter 5 and 4. We have mentions of both the Admiral coming to see Holland and being all, yo, what up on the Admiral, but it might not have been the Admiral. And also with the two boats, which are side by side and they look very similar, if not the same.
Mm-hmm.
That theme of impersonation is also something that Knox brings up. I definitely think there's some impersonation somewhere in the story or someone who is actually someone else. My kind of theory that I've been tossing around in my head is that maybe Holland is Walter, which is Elmer's like long lost brother.
Surely Peniston would have recognized his own nephew.
Maybe he did. Maybe that's why he was so, like, against the marriage. He was like, this ain't right. There's a marriage of convenience to say nothing else. I ain't happy with it.
But then he could have just redrafted the will, could he not? You know, if he had a problem with Holland. It seems like Holland's relationship with Elmer has gone on for most of the month that they've been in town.
Maybe this was something that Peniston was, like, not sure on. You know, he was like, this is a bit weird, but it sorts out the problem of getting Walter back into the family. Maybe his eyesight isn't good. Maybe that's a twist. I don't know.
And that's why he dropped the key, of course.
There you go. That's it. It's something that I've been tossing around my head because I definitely think with all these mentions of impersonations and characters not being, you know, characters looking the same, I think there has to be something. And I'm not saying that there are actually 18 different Rudges that all exist in this story and that the plot twist at the end is like a cloning facility and that every single Rudge is equal and they fight to the death on an island. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen, but if it did, that'd be pretty crazy.
Are you telling me that Hong Kong is just the Hunger Games Rudge edition?
Yes.
Okay.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Oh,
so
God.
Strap in. Get ready for Katniss Everdeen to play 18 different Rudges. She's going to whack on a beard. It's going to be great. Point is, there is room for a theory in which Holland is actually long-lost brother Walter. And that is the hill that I will die on, apparently.
That's where we're going? You're locking that in?
I'm not sure. This is the problem.
So wait, who's killed
who? It's too many. Elmer, clearly.
So Elmer has killed the Admiral.
Yes.
And Holland is Walter.
Yes. They killed him to preserve their secret.
And of course, his trading business is thus, you know, the thing that Walter was in trouble for with the law.
Yes.
Right.
Maybe he was involved in those opium dens back in Hong Kong.
And that's what the introduction. Okay.
That makes sense.
I'm on board.
And then Peniston is like, yo, I trust you enough because you're my nephew, so I'm not going to bring my loaded gun with me. However, we're going to have a chat about this marriage thing and how weird it is.
Right.
And then Holland is like, put that in writing. And then he does. And then either Elmer or Holland stabs him with the steak knife in the boat.
But what about Nettie Ware?
Nettie Ware is just a stand-up guy. He found a corpse and he reported it like a good citizen, like a good Christian.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you for joining us on Death of the Reader. That's Herds' prevailing theory.
It's actually Nettie.
As we go into...
Lock it in, Nettie.
As we go into our final week, will he be right? Will he be wrong?
Maybe.
Or will Mrs. Davis be behind it all along?
With the newspaper. Oh, it was so obvious.
Next week on Death of the Reader, we'll be covering from chapters 9 till the end of The Floating Admiral. And yes, that does mean the appendices as well.
Good luck.
If you're reading along, be sure to read those. They are a monster. We'll see you next week.